All right, so we are looking at parables. And so if you have your Bible, you can turn to Luke 12. We're going to look at another parable. And the reason we're looking at parables, just to remind you, or if you haven't been here the last couple of weeks, is that stories are more than the sum of their parts, right? Stories are beyond just a list of facts, but stories engage us, they resonate with us, they touch our hearts in a way that pure information does not always accomplish. And parables specifically, the way that Jesus uses them, on the one hand, you can absolutely teach a parable to your children and you don't have to worry about that. You don't have to be like, oh my goodness, there's so much more here that they're not understanding. That's okay. Just as we teach anything from the Bible to our kids, we do so recognizing that they're going to grow and they're going to learn and they're going to understand it at their level. But parables, while in one sense are easy to understand, in another sense, they're actually there's such depth to them. It's almost mysterious. They're almost enigmatic. And they cause us to lean in. They cause us to think more deeply than we would have otherwise. And this is why Jesus teaches in parables. It's not to simply give an answer, but to paint a picture that causes his listeners and now us as we read them to contemplate further and to allow whatever Jesus is telling us through that to penetrate our hearts in a new, richer, more robust way than if he simply said, here's the right answer. Okay? There's so much more to it than that. And so we're looking at a parable this week. Probably most of these parables are familiar to you. If they're not, that's okay. That's even better because you're going to read it with fresh eyes. And so that's what I want us to try to do as we read a parable of the rich fool. Some of you are going to say, I've heard this before. I understand it. I'm sure that you do. I did. And your kids can understand it again at a very at their level. But what we want to do is try to dig a little bit deeper and really think about what Jesus is trying to communicate to us and maybe some of the questions that Jesus wants us to wrestle with. Again, he's not giving an answer. He's painting a picture that should cause us to think, to contemplate, to ask the question. And so we're, in some ways, we're not going to try to answer the questions. We're going to try to figure out what the questions are. Does that make sense? Okay. So the parable of the rich fool, Luke chapter 12. And I love how this starts out because it's kind of abrupt. Verse 13, someone in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." And so you have this picture actually of almost like this crowd of people. And it's like this voice, almost this faceless, nameless voice just kind of shouts out, "Teacher, tell my brother to quit being a jerk." Which, as a parent of boys, can I tell you, I feel like I hear this a lot. This is not an unusual request in my world. Well, one of my boys comes to me, "Dad, you know, tell Gabriel to quit doing this, or he's doing this to me," or I started to say she, but she's not doing anything to anybody. She's 11 months. But the boys, right? That's how that plays out. And so if most of us are parents in here, then you understand. Like this is a very common sort of my brother is not being fair. My brother's not being nice. And so it raises an interesting question because, well, actually, let's read what Jesus says. Just verse 14, though. Jesus replied, "Man, who appointed me a judge or an arbiter between you?" Now, here's what's fascinating about Jesus' response to me is that Jesus he doesn't seem very pleased with this request. So he hears this voice, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance." And Jesus' response here is kind of harsh, actually. When he says "man," in Middle Eastern culture, this is a very rough response. It's essentially, "Who are you? I don't know who you are." And so he doesn't give him a name. He doesn't call him friend, as he does in other passages in response. He says, "Man, who am I? Why are you talking to me? Why are you asking me?" And so Jesus immediately has this, he's communicating displeasure. He's not happy about this request. Now, why not? Why not? Before you get all spiritual on me and try to like fully unpack this, just again, think about, I think about my two kids. They ask me this question all the time. They ask me to intervene. They ask me to be the judge between them all the time. So at a superficial level, let's just start there. What's wrong with this request? Or maybe what is he asking at the heart of it? What's wrong with this request? is there something wrong? I mean, he's asking him, what's he asking Jesus to do?
To be a judge.
To be a judge. And what does he want Jesus to do as judge?
Make a decision. It could be a trap because Jesus has been trapped. Everywhere he goes, the Pharisees are trapping him.
Okay.
Like, what are you doing? Are you trying to trap me here?
Okay, so maybe there's some skepticism on Jesus' part, but as a judge, does he have a verdict in mind? Right? When he asked that question, he's like, I want you to be judge. And by the way, when I ask you to be judge, I want you to rule in a particular way.
Yeah, I mean, he's leading the witness.
Okay, right. Or leading the judge in this case, yeah?
Judge,
yeah.
Right, yeah.
So he's telling him, this is what I want you to do. I want you to be judge.
And oh, by the way.
And oh, by the way, this is how I want you to answer it. Okay, now what? And how does he want him to solve it? Like if you were having this conversation with this man, he said, well, why should I tell your brother to divide the inheritance with you? Why should I do that? He would say, because
I deserve it.
Because I deserve it. What else though? That's right. If he wanted to be really like,
my brother's a jerk.
Yeah, okay, so let's go the other direction. So one is like really honest, my brother's a jerk, I deserve it. But if he wants to be a little bit, you know, sound, how do I put it, like righteous in this, what would he say?
It's the fair thing to do.
Yeah. He's asking for fairness, yeah.
What was the custom at that time in this situation?
So the custom in this time was that everything had to go through the older brother. And so the older brother essentially acted as like a distributor of the wealth. And so, and then I'd have to look back, and I don't remember specifically, but there were like proportions. So there was the larger portion that was given to the elder brother, and then there was like smaller portions that were divvied up beyond, okay? But all of that would go through the older brother. So he essentially serves as executor of the will. So that's why this younger brother, presumably as we're reading this, is saying, tell my older brother to give me what is rightfully mine.
Is that what he's saying by saying to, it's translated divide. So he's asking for what he thinks should be his, or
yes,
according to custom.
The implication, as best we understand it, most scholars will say, no, according to custom. His brother is being unfair. His brother is not giving him what is rightfully his. So it could be, to your point, it could be that he's asking his brother to divide it evenly. But that doesn't seem to be the request. It's more likely that he's saying, my brother knows what's rightfully mine. He's not giving it to me.
Of course, the question begs is, why is his brother doing this in the first place? Is it because he's acting a certain way, therefore he's withholding it from him?
Right. So you have all kinds of backstory that we don't really know about. What we do understand is he seems to be, and what's interesting is it seems like it doesn't matter, right? I mean, Luke doesn't unpack the story for us. Presumably Jesus knows, and Jesus does seem to know something because as we see his response, because Jesus doesn't give him the ruling that he wants, as we're going to see. So we have this person who just says, just generically, tell my brother to divide my inheritance, to divide with me what is rightfully mine, or to give to me what is rightfully mine. And it is framed in the sense of what is fair. This is what is fair. This is what is rightfully mine. And this is, as a parent, can I just tell you, this is often how we approach these. And I'm not saying this is a wrong way to approach this, by the way. But oftentimes when our kids come to us, we are looking for the fair solution. This is a very natural response to, okay, let me get to the bottom of this. Who hit who first? Okay, and what did you do to provoke him? Right, and we try to unpack it and we go, okay, here's the fair solution for both parties in play. The man's request here is really a request for justice. It's a request for fairness. It's a request to get what is his due. He's being unfairly cheated. He wants what's rightfully his, which raises an interesting question. I want to spend a little bit of time unpacking, and that is this question of justice, okay? This is it's a very hot and a very important topic in our world right now. It's a very important topic in our world, justice. And justice is this idea of receiving what is rightfully yours. It is receiving your due. In that sense, there is a fairness component that's in play. But it's beyond fairness. It's a little bit beyond that. So let's ask this just for a second. So you said earlier, he wants what he deserves. Okay. if we use the definition of justice, that it is getting what is your due, we have a little bit of a problem. What do we deserve?
Wages of sin or death.
Okay. So in that sense, we don't deserve anything good. Okay, all right. What do we deserve? Do we deserve something other than death? No. Okay. So let's think of justice within the context of two relationships. And I think you have to have both of these in play to understand it. Justice has two relationships. The one that you guys immediately, because you are Christians and you're a church, immediately move to is our relationship with God. So here's us. Okay. This is us. And we immediately went to this relationship that from God, there is nothing that we deserve. Okay, the wages of sin is death. Anything that we deserve is bad because of sin. So in this relationship here, we are undeserving. But there's another relationship, and that is our relationship in this direction with others. And in this relationship, it's different, isn't it? I mean, how many of you get paid to do nothing? Tommy, great. One. Most people don't. There is some element of working for what you receive in our relationship with others. There is a sense of which you work, how you interact with people, there is justice, there is fairness, there are these things that we deserve in our relationships with one another. And it's not just wages. What else do we deserve from other people?
Respect.
Yeah, respect. What else?
Love.
Yeah, okay, love. What else? So those are great. Why do we deserve that from each other? What is that rooted in? We do deserve respect. I would say that people deserve dignity, to be treated with dignity, put it that way. Yeah, so they're made in the image of God. So it is what God bestows upon us that we do not deserve. In his grace, he bestows the image of God upon us. We are created in the image of God, and that he bestows dignity and honor and value upon us in his creation of us, that then influences how we deserve to be related to one, or how we deserve to be treated by one another. And that's actually why we pay people for doing work, too. This is actually ultimately rooted back in. It's a respect for someone for how they have worked. It's an honor to them. It's valuing their contribution. It's valuing them as people. And all of that is rooted in this idea that we are made in the image of God. And so it's what God bestows upon us freely, graciously, that we do not deserve, that then leads us to a place where there is a sense of which we deserve from one another, respect, to be treated with dignity, to be honored, to be loved. Does that make sense? Okay. So, look at this. So, within this context, then, what does it mean when we think about justice? I feel like I'm skipping a step here as I'm looking at my notes. As we deserve, okay, here's where I'm going to go with this, sorry. Recently at a luncheon, I heard a guy named Brian Fickert, I think is how you say his name. He wrote a book called When Helping Hurts. And he made a very interesting point that I think is very helpful. He said, he asked the question, what is poverty? Okay. And how would we define poverty off the top of your head? Yeah, revenue line.
That's not the government.
Right. It's a revenue line. It's the lack of material goods or lack of funds at a certain level. Okay, so material goods. And what Brian Fickert points out is that if you talk to people who are poor, they almost never bring up money. what they bring up is a lack of dignity. They bring up that they are not treated as human, that they are treated less than human, that they are invisible, that no one cares for them, that there's a lack of compassion that other people feel towards them or act towards them, which is a fascinating idea when we think about, as this parable is going to lead us into, when we think about the essence of life and we think about the essence of wealth. And so what God bestows upon us in the image of God, what this does is it defines then what we deserve from one another. And even when we think about wages or we think about material goods and so on, that is within the context of honoring, of bestowing dignity, of valuing other people. And when you take this beyond the individual and you put this at a corporate level, we begin to understand justice in a much fuller sense. We begin to see justice as a restoration of God's intention for humanity. Okay, Timothy Keller, in his book Generous Justice, he explains that the way he describes this is that the fabric of society as God intends it is how God refers to it as shalom. So in the Hebrew, this is shalom is a word for peace, but it's not peace in the sense of a lack of war. It's peace in the sense of everything in its right place, of balance, of order, of how people interact with one another, everything as it should be. And that justice is essentially the preservation of and the protection of and the restoration of that sense of shalom within society, of how we should all interact with one another, of how the world should operate. So that injustice, this lack of fairness, is essentially a tearing, a breaking apart of shalom. So when Jesus responds here, he says, who made me judge and arbiter? We have to understand it in this context of what this person is asking for in fairness and justice goes far beyond just the individual, and it goes far beyond just getting what he deserves. It goes far beyond what he is hoping to receive from his brother. It goes into the very heart of what this person thinks justice is about. It goes into the heart of what he thinks life is about. So let's look at Jesus' response. Am I making sense at this point? Okay. Sorry, I feel like I got a little bit off track there. I think I missed a step in my own thoughts. So if you guys are tracking with me, fantastic. All right. So Jesus says, "Man, who appointed me as a judge or an arbiter between you?" At this point, let me make two points real quick. One is that the gospel should lead us to seek justice. Why is that? What does the gospel have to do with justice? Okay, so let's think of it in terms of justice within this world, within our society. Okay, so yes, you're correct. God justified us when we didn't deserve it. So Jesus cares a lot about justice. In fact, if you go back to Luke 4, you can flip back there just for a second. You find this throughout Scripture, actually. Read any of the prophets. You find that the idea of this spiritual versus, you know, physical or heavenly versus earthly dichotomy, God doesn't have a whole lot of room for that. If you read any of the prophets, there's a call for justice. There's a call to treat other people fairly. Jesus in Luke 4, he says, I'll just read this real fast. He's quoting from Isaiah, and he says, "The Spirit of the Lord is on me because he has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners and recovery of sight for the blind, to release the oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." So Jesus is saying, I've come here, and I have come for the sake of justice, both in the spiritual and in the physical world. Like, this is going to be ultimately fulfilled in the kingdom. So he's come, he proclaims the kingdom, and there's a spiritual freedom, but there's also a restoration, again, of justice that will ultimately be fulfilled when all things are made right. So Jesus cares a lot about justice, and the gospel, the message itself, it should push us towards seeking justice and fairness within our world. But why? Why is that? I'm hinting at it, but help me unpack this a little bit.
It's the idea of shalom, right? It's putting everything back to where it should have been.
Right.
So man and God, man sinned, so the plan was from the very beginning to put everything back to
yes.
where it was. Before they sin.
Good.
To have the relationship back with God.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a great answer. So the gospel is God's plan of redeeming humanity. It's his message of reconciling us to himself, and it is of restoring us to the full image that we were originally created with and to have. Okay. So the gospel, in a very practical sense, should within our world lead us to treat others with dignity. It should lead us to treat others with respect. It should lead us to love people. Okay. And it should do so regardless of whether they've earned it in one sense. This goes for, and I didn't bring this up earlier, but you think of someone who is unable, physically capable to work. When we think about justice, this is an equality. We think about providing people for what they need. Okay, it doesn't mean that everybody gets a, you know, Rolls Royce, but it means that everyone has what they need in light of the fact that they're made in the image of God. And so this is part of the restoration process that God has begun, initiated through Christ's death and resurrection, that we are part of that restoration process. So the next part of this question then is, why can't we have justice without the gospel, or can we? Can we have justice apart from the gospel, real justice, full justice? And why not? Because I'm going to say no. Just give that to you for free.
God is the definer of everything, so if you remove him from the equation, there is no definition of anything.
Very good. I think that's good. Do you guys understand that? So I think there's two. That's the one I want to get back to. There's a second reason why we can't have justice without the gospel. So the first one, so what Alan just said there, is that the first reason is that we can't even understand justice apart from the gospel, that God defines what justice is. The other part of it is, I just hit on real quickly, is that the gospel actually empowers justice. So think of it in terms of we can, within society, we can legislate a certain amount of justice, correct? We can try to create fair play. We can try to create even playing fields and get everyone the same, you know, more or less the same chance. We can try to legislate some of that, but it all hangs on a razor's edge. Because as sinful people, we're always working and trying in our sinfulness to take advantage of other people. We're always looking to leverage, to give ourselves just a little bit more power, a little bit more privilege than everybody else. We're always looking to... And it doesn't have to be explicit. We don't have to be twirling our mustaches and being evil. It's just the natural inclination of our hearts to take advantage of whatever opportunities, whatever privileges that we have. But the gospel cuts through that, correct? The message of the gospel itself is that Jesus places the interests of others above his own. Philippians 2:4. And then that very next passage, what does it say about Christ? That he pours himself out for the sake of others. And so for the only reason for within society for these, for our abuse, I will say, of power and privilege to be undermined, for the legs to be cut out from under it, is for the gospel to reign, for Christ to break in and to say, this is not how power and privilege should be used. So in that sense, the gospel, it empowers true justice. You cannot have justice, real justice, apart from the gospel. But I really like what Alan was saying about how justice, how the gospel defines justice. And this is what Jesus is saying right here. Man, who appointed me a judge or an arbiter between you? In this moment, is Jesus acting as a judge? Okay, so we got a number of things going on, and you're all right. So Jesus said, what does he say, Andrea? You've got something in mind.
Well, he didn't come to judge at this time.
Right. He's going to do that later.
Right.
Right? He says, I didn't come to judge. I didn't come to condemn the world. I came to save the world. So that's true. He's acting as priest because he's going to offer up a sacrifice for all people, and that sacrifice is him. But it's interesting. Here, he's not acting as a judge of people. But as Alan said, why'd you say he is?
Well, based upon his statement, he's judging his heart based upon what he's trying to get him to do.
Yeah.
Right? So he's judging his heart, therefore his statement is, why are you asking me to do this? So it's a judgment that he's looked at the evidence and said, I'm really interested in your heart, not in what actually you're asking me to do.
Yeah. So I'm going to I agree with you. I'm going to phrase it slightly different. I'm going to say that he's judging this man's view of justice. So he's saying, I want you to be the judge, and I want you to come up with this verdict. And he says, I'm going to take a step above that. I'm not going to be down here where you want me. I'm not here to serve you and your cause for justice. I'm actually going to take my rightful place as God and say, hey, your view of justice is deficient. It's not right. There's something wrong here in your view of justice. See, one of the problems with justice is that it requires a judge as well. Who defines our justice? Who's going to tell us what justice is and what justice isn't? Leslie Newbegin writes this. He says, all human causes are ambiguous, and all human actions are involved in the illusions, which are the product of our egotism. Let me read that again, and I'll unpack it for you, okay? Actually, he's going to explain it. All human causes are ambiguous, and all human actions are involved in the illusions, which are the products of our egotism. In other words, what he says is, hey, you think you're being just, and you're really working for you. You like to think that you're just, you like to think that you're being fair, you like to think that you're really noble and honorable and all the rest of it, but really, you're just serving yourself. That's what he's saying. So he goes on. He says, if we acknowledge the God of the Bible, we are committed to struggle for justice in society. So what does he say right there? It's what we said just a moment ago. He says, the gospel requires us. It should push us to seek for justice. If we acknowledge the God of the Bible, we are committed to struggle for justice in society. Justice means, he's going to define it, giving each his due. But here's the problem. Our problem, as seen in the light of the gospel, is that each of us overstates what is due him compared with what is due his neighbor. Did you catch that? We're all going to overestimate. I deserve this, which is always a little bit more than everybody else. If I do not acknowledge a justice which judges the justice for which I fight, I am an agent not of justice but of lawless tyranny. In other words, he says, look, we need the gospel to shape and define how we understand justice. Otherwise, our justice is nothing more than egotism. Otherwise, it's nothing more than me fighting for me. Me fighting for what I want. Going to show you one thing real quick. So there's this guy. I just forgot his first name. His last name's Kling. What's his first name? Arnold Kling. He offers he suggests a three-axis ideological model for seeing society and seeing the world. And here's his model, okay? Kind of looks like this. On the one hand, you have the oppressed, coercion, and chaos. Over here, you have order, freedom. Sorry, this is wrong. Freedom. This is coercion. And then this is oppressor. All right, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but let me just explain real quick. People see the world in different ways. Everybody knows that, right? Everybody's got a different lens through which we see the world, we interpret the world, we understand the world. And he says this is kind of three very broad sense of which categories for how we see the world. Some people see the world as a struggle between order and chaos, between civilization and barbarism, if you want to get a little more, you know, fun with it. Some people see it as a struggle between coercion and freedom. Some people see it as a struggle between the oppressor and the oppressed. And then he's going to explain this within political. He's a political commentator and an economist. So he's going to see this in political terms. But what we found is in our society right now, we spend a lot of time talking about the oppressor and the oppressed. Right? This is the cause for justice. This is the paradigm for justice. Okay. And the danger here is, has been pointed out, is that as those who are oppressed fight against their oppressors, oftentimes what happens?
They become the other.
Why? It's just what Leslie Newbegin said. It's because if we do not have someone to judge our justice, we will simply become those that we are fighting against. If we do not have God, Jesus, here to serve as judge, to say, your view of justice is out of line, it is out of order, there is something that you're missing, it's deficient in some way, then we will become whoever we're fighting against. And so this model of the oppressor and oppressed simply flip-flops. And whoever wins, it simply becomes a matter of who wields the biggest stick, right? So you rise up, you throw off your oppressor, and you become them. Except when there's the gospel. Except when Jesus is the one who ultimately is defining and shaping our idea of justice. Does that make sense? Does that make sense? Okay. So Jesus says, look, I'm not going to take this bait. I'm not going to just tell you, oh, here's the right answer. Instead, he says, your view of justice is deficient because you think that your self-interest outweighs the interests of your brother. You think that being fair is more important than your relationship with your brother. So in one sense, he's asking for fairness, but let's think again about this big picture of shalom. Okay, so within shalom, fair play is a piece of that puzzle, correct? But it's not the whole piece. There's also a piece of reconciliation, of right relationship with others. That's part of that as well. And so to sacrifice one for the other is not a full picture of shalom. It's not a picture of right justice. And so Jesus, again, sees, as Alan said, he sees his heart, sees his desire for himself over his relationship with his brother, and says, there's something wrong here. I'm not going to play your game. Instead, he says, let's get to your very idea of what it means, the essence of life, of wealth, because that's what's at heart here. So verse 15, then he said to him, watch out, be on your guard against all kinds of greed. A man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. So he's taking this to yet another level. This is what Jesus is always doing. He's always taking us to another level. So here's your idea of justice. Your idea of justice is rooted in your idea of what it means to be human. It's rooted in your idea of what it means to be wealthy, of to have the abundant life. And you think that life is about material goods. You think that life is about having enough stuff. So let me tell you, you're missing it. You're missing it. And so now he's going to give him the parable. You knew we'd get there. Verse 16, and he told them this parable. The ground of a certain rich man produced a good crop. He thought to himself, what shall I do? I have no place to store my crops. Interesting, real quick. Wealth isolates. Think about this. This guy, and you see this throughout this parable, he's talking to himself the whole time. He doesn't talk to anybody else. Now, in Middle Eastern culture, this would have been unheard of. You would have had your family in, even for small decisions. You would have had everybody you know come around, hey, let's talk about this. Let's hash this out. Give me wise counsel. We're going to talk about this. Not this guy. He's got everything that he needs. And now he has separated himself from everyone else. We live, as an aside, kind of a wealthy place and kind of a wealthy part of the world, the country, and in time. And we are isolated. And you guys feel this because this is part of why we go to church, right? It's to worship God with others in community, which is how we worship God. But wealth, man, there's such a danger of it isolating us. I don't know about you. I have a rear, like my house has a driveway in the back, so that if I'm lucky, I will never have to see or be seen by a neighbor. Never, right? Keep trying. Anyway, I'm joking. Right? I have to make a concerted effort if I want to meet anyone in my neighborhood. I have to work at it. And then I get in my car, and I can ride around in my little isolation mobile, you know, and I never have to talk to anybody unless I choose to call them. Otherwise, I can just ignore everyone. Right? No one in the history of the world has ever been able to be as isolated as we are. And it is a result of the fact that we can afford to be. Poor people can't live like that, in case you're wondering. There was a, I'm going to skip that story. All right. It was a little cynical even for me, but it was really, ask me later. It's funny. So this is what's happened to this person. He has everything that he needs. He has all of his needs met. And so he confers with no one. There's no one else in his life. He's isolated. So he tells them this parable. The ground of a certain rich man produced a crop, and he thought to himself, "Self, what shall I do? I have no place to store my crops." Then he said, "This is what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I'll say to myself, you have plenty of good things laid up for many years. Take life easy. Eat, drink, and be merry." So here's the question. What is the rich man's view of life? What's the essence of life for him? Yeah, so it's material. It's almost animalistic, right? There's no relationships. There's no, God isn't in the picture. It's eat, drink, and be merry. In other words, it's how can I use the things that I have to satisfy my appetites, right? It's almost a lack of humanity in how he views life. And how does he view wealth? What's that?
As a means to comfort.
Okay? Does it go beyond his means of comfort? Does it go beyond material goods in any way? He doesn't have a wealth of friends. Doesn't have a wealth of relationships. He doesn't have a wealth in his relationship with God or in any other area of his life that we see. He is one-dimensional. His idea of life, of wealth, are exactly not what we said real wealth was earlier, right? If poverty is a lack of being recognized, a lack of humanity, a lack of dignity, then wealth means it should be more than material possessions. But he lacks all of that. In fact, he has a surplus. And what does he do with the surplus? He's trying to store it, right?
He can use it later.
Right. So all of this, so this is where Jesus is not going to let us off the hook, and he doesn't give easy answers. The questions that he's raising here are, okay, what is life to you? What is the essence of your life? And in that, how do you define wealth? What does it mean for you to be wealthy? Is it how God desires us to understand life in all of its riches and its fullness? Or have we bought into this idea, this one-dimensional idea, that life means how much I have and the material goods that I can possess and that I can collect? And my surplus, does that belong to me? Or is all of this a good gift from God? And I'm not speaking against savings accounts or anything like that, but there is a question here of who does it belong to? What are we using it for? And maybe the most profound question here is, how much is enough? He has plenty, but he collects a surplus and he saves it. And the question that I think we're supposed to wrestle with is, how much is enough? How much do we need?
A little bit more,
that's right. Was it Rockefeller who said that? Rockefeller, how much do you need? A little bit more. And I feel that.
Sin always wants more, and because it's a part of us, we always want more of everything.
Yeah.
So there never is enough.
And it's idolatry plays a part, right? So there's a sense here of what he has is what he worships. And whatever you have that you're worshiping requires always more and more worship, which then feeds an addiction. I mean, it all wraps up together. I've been thinking a lot about this lately, that we live in a culture that worships upgrade. We live in a culture that demands upgrade. I don't know about you, my phone tells me when I need to upgrade. I deserve an upgrade, that's right. I just got a text from my cell phone carrier that told me that I qualified for a new phone, which is even better. I don't think they're giving it to me for free, though. It's just an upgrade, right? We're challenged, we're like enticed, that's a better word, to upgrade everything. And we are constantly looking to upgrade.
Or supersize.
But think about I've been thinking about upgrades specifically. To upgrade my career, to upgrade my salary, to upgrade my house, to upgrade my car, to upgrade my spouse, to upgrade my kids, to upgrade myself, my physical appearance, right? All of these things that we are told every day, all the time, you need to upgrade. It needs to be a little bit better. You deserve better. You can have a little bit more. And something I've been trying to allow to sink into my own heart and what I want to communicate to my kids is the gift of enough. Enough is a beautiful, beautiful thing. Proverbs speaks of enough as the greatest gift, because it's too easy if I have too much to no longer rely on the Lord, and if I have too little to be tempted to steal. But if I have enough, here's the key, to recognize that I have enough and to see it as a gift, how that frees me from this constant need to upgrade. And how do I communicate that to my kids, this need, this gift of enough? I see this with my kids a lot. I don't know about you. All my kids are different. Shocker. Everybody's got more than one. You understand this. And one of my kids, I can tell, this is going to be his struggle. Another one of my kids has a different struggle. We had a long chat about that last night. He's got a different issue. His issue is my issue. I won't tell you what that is. It's self-control with your temper. That was mine growing up. It was my dad's, it's mine, and it's his, and I see it. We talked over and over last night. I had him repeat after me, if I do not control my anger controls me. So that was our conversation last night. But I've got another one who this is his issue. I can see it. This is what's coming. He always wants an upgrade. He always wants an upgrade. And so how do we begin to model that for our kids? And so, because this is how this ends. I mean, we haven't even read the last verse here. But God said to him, "You fool, this very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you have prepared for yourself?" And Jesus closes, "This is how it will be with anyone who stores up things for himself but is not rich toward heaven." Jesus is echoing sentiment of Ecclesiastes. Right? You have the author of Ecclesiastes, if you go back to chapter 2, I think it is, and he speaks of this, basically it's in the persona of Solomon saying, hey, I can collect all this stuff and what was it good for? And he says, in the end, it's nothing, but also, who do I leave it for? Like, I accumulated all this stuff just to be left to somebody else to waste or burn or whatever. And so Jesus is echoing the futility of this type of collection, this type of pursuit, the futility of this view of life, this view of wealth. Jesus, other places, this isn't speaking specifically of salvation, but it's worth noting that it is possible to gain the world and lose your soul. So how do we do this? How do we model this for our kids? And what are we teaching our kids about the essence of life? What are we teaching our kids about what it means to be truly wealthy? I don't really have any answers for this. This is what I'm trying to figure out. Something that especially as I see my kids struggling with this, and they don't realize they're struggling with it, but I see their hearts. I see how they're inclined. I know how my own heart is inclined. How do we model this? You know, is it simply a matter of not buying them things? Is it simply a matter of making sure they get good teaching from Scripture? Is it a matter of having them serve others? Is it require also seeing how other people live? Maybe it's all of those things. But as always, where we always end is it starts with us. It starts with you and me. We have to push against the isolation of wealth. And we have to push against this falling into this idea that this is how I should define my life. And we have to appreciate and come to savor the gift of enough. And I think it's a beautiful gift. I really do. The more I think about it, the more I'm grateful for enough. There is a sense of gratitude that comes with that, and also a sense of generosity that is born out of it. And I think those are both beautiful things. Other people's thoughts?
You need to want what you have instead of have what you want.
There you go. Yeah, be appreciate. Yes, have an appreciation for what you have.
Along those lines, I think cultivating gratefulness
yes.
is really important to that.
Yeah.
Both in modeling it, being grateful for my mm-hmm. own things, not like commenting on things that I wish were different.
Yeah.
Even in the house, you know, I'm always
yeah.
like, we're always like working on improving our house, and there's a temptation to fall into, you know, well, we just need new carpet in this room, or we just need to repaint mm-hmm. that room, or whatever.
Yeah.
But to be sure that the words that are coming out of my mouth are ones that express gratefulness for things as they are. And then also to encourage the kids, I've been working with them lately on helping them to verbalize their own gratefulness, and that's been mm-hmm. really difficult. Most of the time when I ask them, it's, I don't know. Like, you know, the main three things you're grateful for, I don't know.
Yeah.
And so I'm trying to like, you know, start leading in, giving them suggestions. Well, how about this or how about that? And we're slowly starting to see some headway there, but mm-hmm. it takes a lot of... It's definitely not our normal human response to things,
yeah.
is to think of things to be grateful for.
I use the tell me three things that you're thankful for a lot. My kids are maybe a little older, and so or maybe they're used to, I don't know. They do that fairly well, and it is remarkable how that changes their attitude, at least for a little bit.
Right.
Another thing that I think, and this is one that I'm really guilty of, that I have to be careful about with modeling for my kids, is when they ask for something, I want to go do this, or I want this, or whatever, is I also need to be careful that I don't always, my first response oftentimes is, that's expensive. We can't afford it, which is true oftentimes. But what I found is that has begun to make them think, well, then we just need more money. That's their solution. And so instead, what I want to do is ask, well, why do you need this? Why do you want this? And help them begin to process that and think more in terms of needs, gifts, like what do you need versus what is bonus? What is a gift that we can be grateful for? And recognize we don't always get what we want, and it's not good to always get what we want, but being careful not to create a sense of, well, if we just had more money, then I could have everything that I want, because that again is directing their heart in the wrong direction. Does that make sense? Yeah, James.
I like your point about need versus want.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I think we use that term need when we really need wants.
Yeah. I need a new phone.
Right. With my kids trying to
yeah.
make sure they understand the difference, and many times when they're saying need, it actually means they want this.
Yeah.
They actually need it.
Yeah.
I remember after the birth of my first, I ended up having postpartum depression, and when we went to our marital counselor, he said that one thing that would help with that was doing a gratefulness chart. Obviously, my son was not involved with this. He was like 3 years old.
Right. Didn't contribute a whole lot at that point.
Yeah, he just stared at it. But we did a gratefulness chart because he was talking to us about, you know, every night we would write one thing that we were grateful for. And sometimes it was repeat, you know, but he talked to us about how not only does it, talking about what you're grateful for isn't just something that brings up gratitude, but also brings up a sense of hope. You know?
Mm.
So if you're in a, you know, like for me, when I was in this stint of time where I felt absolutely hopeless,
right,
it was a gentle reminder every single day that even in these small ways, God is unfaithful, and so
yeah.
he's there and he's functioning.
No, that's a great point.
Like,
yeah.
It went beyond, I think it's a great thing to do just to bring up gratitude for like our children in the future, but
mm-hmm.
it was also something that I needed in that moment to remember, like no matter
yeah.
what, I'm still moving forward.
Yeah. Yeah, this is something not just, I think it's a great point, both for the hope and also... a reminder that, again, this is not just for our kids, but what are we modeling? And are we grateful for the things that God has given to us, the gifts that we have? Yeah.